You're listening to Symposium, a year-round conference in the arts, brought to you by Pipeline Artists. So welcome to the Insights into Post-Strike Film and TV Industry Symposium. And we're going to spend the next hour talking to Lee Jessop and Jeff Portnoy. And let me give you a little introduction. Lee Jessop is a career coach for screenwriters, specializing in guiding emerging and professional scribes toward longstanding and prolific screenwriting careers in both TV and feature writing. Additionally, she has provided consulting services to NBC International, the Universal Writers Program, the Final Draft Big Break Contest, and Inevitable Foundation, and is an adjunct professor with the David Lynch Graduate School of Cinematic Arts. Her one-on-one coaching clients include everyone from showrunners and studio writers to contest winners, TV writing fellows, as well as writers just starting out. She is also the author of the best-selling books, Break-In, Tales from the Screenwriting Trenches, and Getting It Right, An Insider's Guide to a Screenwriting Career, both of which are excellent books and I have. And then literary manager Jeff Portnoy has been working at Bellevue Productions in Los Angeles for the past 8 years, representing writers and filmmakers working in both features and episodic. Before that, he worked at Creative Artists Agency as a story analyst, the Gotham Group as an executive assistant, and Resolution Talent Agency as the head of their story development and agent trainee. Jeff has a Bachelor of Fine Arts degree in film and video production from Point Park University in Pittsburgh. Oh, Pittsburgh, go Steelers, and attended UCLA Extension's Writing and Film and Television Program. A former aspiring writer himself, Jeff has extensive experience with and a genuine love for developing screen and teleplays with writers and then helping those writers sell their materials, find writing jobs, and secure agency representation. Along with his colleague, John Zelzerny, Jeff was featured in Variety Magazine as a new leader in 2018. So we're going to get started with some discussion and conversation, but we would like the rest of you to feel free to put any questions you have in the Q&A box. So Matt, you want to start it off?
Before we go to the Q&A box, I just want to
tell you who Matt is.
I've been here before. There's a lot of regulars here. I'm a pipeline person. So just that. And I'm asking some questions. And that's all I need to know. There's already questions in the Q&A box. Before we get to those, I just want each of your impressions on sort of the outlook for 2024 post WGA strike and post SAG strike. We'll start with Jeff, but I want, you know, both of your general thoughts on anything. Let's just go with that.
Yeah,
I'm keeping it broad.
Yeah, look, I mean, I can talk a little bit about this prospects writing wise for writers. You know, there's a lot of different things with the SAG. It's very complicated. I think, you know, I do think that for as long as the strike lasted, which was for the writer strike, I'm saying is lasted 5 months, it's going to take 5 months for things to kind of go back to settle back down to relatively the way they were before in terms. Mm-hmm. So strike ended. Now we have a big glut of, there was a backup of spec scripts. There was a backup of package projects. Everything was built up and now it's all coming out. So it's hectic right now. It's a very hard to get eyes on your script right now. That will settle down. I think there's the first wave was between September 25th and, you know, December 31st. And the second wave of the glut will be January and February. But by March 1st, 2nd, you know, it'll start to be back to the way it was, which is still, it's still hard to get eyes on. It was always hard to get eyes on a script and to sell something. Right. It's just, you know, for 5 months after the strike ended, which was September 25th, just much, much harder. There's right now we're out with my colleagues and I, we're out with a handful of specs and it's just producers are getting inundated. They're getting, I would say, at least three times as many specs as they would normally get. And they have the same amount of reading time. They're slammed. So, that's kind of, I think, you know, it's just going to take time for things to kind of settle.
Yeah, for sure. Lee?
Great. 100%. I mean, it's, I know a lot of writers out there feel like, but what about me? Right? Strike's over. What do I do now? But it's really important to remember that even in a non-strike year, November 15th would have been kind of the cutoff for sending stuff into the industry. If you don't have, you know, industry friends that are sitting and waiting for your script, there is right now a glut of scripts going out. There is still a little bit of a limbo because we have all of these previously packaged projects that have not been able to go out yet because you can't deal on actors while the SAG strike is still happening. So my take on it, my view on it is that ultimately, whether it's agents and managers or producers or executives, everybody's looking for the shortest path right now to a green light, to a go project. And that's going to be content that's already developed, right? So this is actually a really great time for writers to take a step back, not on November 15th when the entire year slows down, but a little bit sooner because we are post-strike and because the interest right now is not in finding those new voices that are going to be important again. But right now is a really great time to like take a step back, look at the body of work, look at what you want to finish before the end of the year, getting into next year, because just like Jeff said, people are going to be tied up for a short period of time, and that's okay, right? We want the industry to be thriving again, because that is an environment in which emerging writers can thrive themselves. But it is something that is going to take attention away from new voices, new writers for a short period of time. We don't have the exact date, but I, like Jeff, I absolutely foresee it going into January, maybe February, in next year. And then there will be some kind of openness to new writers.
Sure. Yeah, even on our end, like circulating our finalists from this season, always very appreciative to Bellevue for reading very, very quickly.
They're the hardest working guys in town, and girl, Kate counts too, but really hardworking management company, couldn't love them more.
I can confirm. There's only a handful of reps and companies that we send to that just read it ultra, ultra fast, and that's appreciated. But yeah, I mean, both of you would recommend then, and this has always been the case, just don't query, don't really send stuff out unless you were working with somebody and they asked to read something of yours. It's just kind of, what's the point? November, December, everyone's inundated. Let them get a chance to catch up, I would assume. Yeah,
I think
absolutely.
So.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's suboptimal. I think right now it's suboptimal, but it'll be optimal, you know, in January, February. But really, I feel, in my opinion, March is when things are going to really feel like they've settled. Post-strike settled. So, but it depends on what you're doing. If you're looking for representation, I would say waiting is better. I'm slammed right now. Everybody's so slammed. If you're a spec and, it's not packaged. Yeah. It's hard right now. So.
And I think it's important for writers to remember, right? The writers who are looking for representation, who are looking for interest in their work, to remember that representation hasn't been getting paid for 5 months. Right. If we want reps to stay afloat, the first thing they need to do is get their existing clients' work out there to get back on more steady ground that everybody was off of for this 5 month period. So I think it's just incredibly important to remember that. You know, I talk to people all the time who are like, yeah, but I really want to make a push before the end of the year because I feel that I want to. And I get it. And I think that everybody has to ask themselves, like, what is the objective of the push? If the objective of push for representation is to say that you did it, by all means, go nuts. I personally think that resources, including time and energy, are limited for everybody, and every effort that you make, you want to maximize its potential. So with that in mind, like Jeff said, like read the room, read the industry. We know where we are now. Let's see where the industry is January, February, and you really have to play it by ear in order to make the most of your efforts.
Yeah, and I know some writers are listening to this right now. Sorry, Jean. Some writers are listening to this right now, and they're like, I got to wait till March. But, like, that's 4 months away.
You don't,
like,
don't if I told to, you, you don't have to, but you should. But it'd be more optimal if you did.
Yeah.
If you did, it's just, you know.
It's the same thing in the publishing world, right? If you're an author and you don't want to really query lit agents over the holidays. But if I told you.
But again, I think.
Yeah.
Sorry, Matt. Just to interject, I think it's really important to remember that as it is, we would have said, wait until the end of January, right? Nobody queries 1st of January, 5th, 10th, right? As it is, you're told to stop from pretty much November 15th until January 25th, 30th, whatever it is, kind of post Sundance. So at the end of the day, we're talking about a few more weeks. And we want writers who get out there and who reach out to representation to have their best opportunity for success, not be automatically shut down because the representative is underwater with existing clients because they have a thriving business. And we need that business to thrive for them to then consider taking on more clients.
Sure.
I wanted to just put a question out there that really isn't necessarily exclusive to a post-strike situation, but I know a lot of people on this Zoom right now want to know, like, okay, so say it's time. Now it's time to query, whatever that means. What is the best way for somebody to query you, to get your attention, to, you know, to get the attention of people in the industry? Is it, you know, like, how should they go about trying to find somebody to rep their work? Like, in your, you know, in the perfect unicorn experience.
Lee, do you want me to take that one, or do you want?
Sure. Why don't you start us off and I'll jump in after.
I mean, look, most queries come in via email. Number one, you want to address the person by their name. I get a lot that are like, dear friends, or dear friends. It's say like, you know, you can tell it's a mass email. You know what I'm saying? Right. It doesn't have your name. It's dear industry member, or dear sir. And if it looks like it's a mass email that's generated for a million people, probably going to get immediately put in the, you know, trash box or whatever, or the trash bin. So you want to, you know, dear Jeff, like, take the time to address it and do an individualized email campaign if you're going to, and then there's also ones where they CC everybody. So you get like, you're in like, there's like 100 managers CC'd and it's just like a mess. That's not going to get anyone anything. So you want to personalize it. That's number one, personalize it, make it look personal, keep it short. I would say always just list one log line. I get a lot of emails where it's like, these are my projects, and it's 3, 5, 10, 15. It's this huge list of all of the log lines and the titles of all their projects. And it's just too much for me to even, you know, consider.
15 is too much. I can confirm, just as a non-manager.
It's their whole body of work. And it's like, I don't have time to do this. Just say like, I have a spec that I've written that I'm really excited about. This is the log line. So keeping it short and sweet, personalizing it, limiting the amount of material you're trying to get them to read. Because we're all really busy. So for me to consider to have to read three, put a piece of bait out in the water. Let me get your hook in my mouth. And then maybe you can add that second one when you pull up. It's a bad analogy, let's put it that way. But you know what I'm saying? Get me hooked on one thing. And then when we're Zooming for the first time, then say, well, I have a second thing. And then I'll go, send me the second thing. And then you're getting the hook in deeper, and then maybe a third thing. But just to hit me with all three, I'm going to be like, I don't even have time to read one thing over the weekend. So we're so busy. I would say use one as a piece of bait. And then if you get a Zoom or a meeting, because I know we do a lot of Zooms, but sometimes we also meet in person, that's when it's, can I tell you about my second thing? When the hook's in a little bit, bring up the second piece.
I have a quick side question before we get to Lee on that note. If I'm a screenwriter and I do have like five scripts that I feel are ready to go, how do I pick which one to send out first? Is it the one I'm most confident in? Is the one that I think is the most quote unquote producible? Or is it all those things?
Well, the two things, look at the log lines, which one's going to get the most attention? So what's the buzziest log line of there's five scripts and the one is going to really get my eye. I get so many of those cold query emails every day that my eye like just scans really quickly and then it goes into the trash. But if I see the log line stands out, and you know, over the years I've signed a few people where it was just the log line. I was like, whoa, that's a real true story, or that's such a high concept idea. And then I'll say, all right, let me see that script. Let me check it out. So log line, but also it's also execution. If you have five scripts and the best quality one has the least amount of like originality conceptually, you know, that's tough, because, and then the one that has the highest concept is the weakest in terms of execution. That's a tough one. So yeah, I mean, ideally it's the best of both, but to get, you're talking about a piece of bait just to get me to click and just take the next step. The log line standing out would be the best for me, would be if it's a really high concept idea. That's the only, I've signed a few people over the years. I've been managing now 9 years and I've signed a handful, maybe five people, through those cold query, just someone reaches out, and it's always been most of the time it's the concept. It's the log line. I'm like, whoa, that's pretty wild.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good answer. I have no notes.
But execution has to be there as well, because ultimately if you deliver a really original concept with a great log line and then the execution is very like, wonk, wonk, That's the end of that conversation, right? Ultimately.
Yes, but not to skew off onto this tangent, but I think it's an important tangent. Wouldn't you agree, though, that a really great, super like buzzy, like you say, but like super fresh, original log line with B-level execution is theoretically better than a ho-hum log line with like A-level execution?
Well,
generally speaking.
As a sample,
because nobody reads the ho-hum log line.
Right.
Nobody asks for that script. Right. So
yeah,
it's tricky. Yeah. I mean, but it depends on what we're reading it for. Like when I'm thinking about signing a client to represent, I will, if I read something that has a great execution, but a ho-hum log line, I'll say to the, I've signed people off those and then said, we're not going to take this one out. Yeah. We're going to work together to find that really exciting log line. You can execute, but this idea is pretty ho-hum. Let's together. And then the next one we have, maybe if all goes well, a great log line, a buzzy idea, and they're executed just as good as that first one. So for discovering talent, I think it's okay to do those. But when you're talking about like managers getting like 20 to 30 to 40 of those emails every day, those queries, and they're already busy to begin with, right. You might need a buzzy idea, like just to, for me to stop. And the only two things, my eyes scan really quickly on those emails, and there's only two things. It's bio and log line, and the bio is whatever their life story, you know, if they have that unique background, something that stands out to me, and the log line is the same thing. And then I'll say, okay, I'm going to just investigate this a little further. Those are the two things I'm looking for. If there's too much text in the email, I'm probably not going to look at it. So it's just like, here's the one log line, here's my bio. Look, if you do two, that's like, okay. But again, the more you add, the less likely I think anyone's going to read it.
Right.
It's the background, it's their bio. And I've done a few times where I've wanted to meet people, just they have that bio that so stands out of their background, their what they've done in their lives is so unique, mm-hmm. in their experience. And it's just, you know, that's when it comes down to it, personalize it and hope that your bio stands out and the log line stands out, really.
No, that's great advice. And before we skew deeper into that rabbit hole, Lee, as far as like writers trying to find representation, get their script out there, what are like kind of the best methods? And I think it's, I have to remind myself, I'm not on the panel. I am operating and I'm going to let the other people talk.
Listen, I think queries, while they're kind of the bottom rung, are still effective. And just to build on some of the things that Jeff said about query letters, I think it's really important to do your research and show your research, right? You're reaching out to Jeff Portnoy because what? He said a thing tonight that resonated with you or somebody else, right? At an event, on a podcast. I'm not a manager. There is nothing about me or my website or information about me out there that implies that I'm a manager. I get query letters, right? Mm-hmm. Which is just should not happen, right? It just shows that people are not doing their research. So I would say, take what Jeff is saying, take it even further. Like, why are you reaching out to him? What is the piece of information because of which you decided that he would be a good fit for you? One of my pet peeves is when writers query and say, you know, if you're interested in my script, I'd love to schedule time to talk once you've had a chance to read it, which for me is just like, you're already asking for a lot. Not only are you asking for somebody's time and a read, but then you're asking for a potential meeting, phone call. And I understand that people work really hard on scripts and want to find those avenues, but you also, as a writer, you have to have the trust that when your script lands, people will want to talk to you on their own. I think, you know, accolades, winning script pipeline, those things can help, but it is going to be about the log line. It is going to be that information. And it's also going to be about the button, like just like Jeff said, the lived experience that a writer brings to the table that really differentiates everything. Now, from there, you know, we also look at competitions, much like your own. You know, you just announced your winners a short while ago, and that creates exposure for the script and the writer. So we always hope for things like that to pave in some inroads. Fellowships are, you know, specifically TV writing fellowships and the Universal Feature Fellowship. If you get in, if you are a finalist, writers can use that that exposure to try and build some momentum for the work. Ultimately, at the end of the day, in a world where nothing is easy, the easiest path in is through referrals. Right. Mm-hmm. So if Matt shows up and tells Bellevue, you guys, there's a script you got to read, they read it and they do it fast. So finding those referrals, industry contacts, other friends who are represented, who may be willing to pass a writer script on, referrals is kind of the fastest path to representation. But there are many, many, many different avenues out there for those writers who don't have industry friends or know other writers. But it is about being thoughtful, picking your script, getting out there.
I think the inevitable question that a lot of, especially newer screenwriters, are going to ask is, how do I get to know somebody who is my referral? Like, how do I network? How do I meet new people outside of, like, you know, having social media communities and things like that? And that's a question that I don't, it's kind of a basic question that with an easy answer, but also like there's a million different ways to do it, right? You can go to conferences and give them the basic advice on that front, but it, all that kind of has to happen organically.
Yeah, but listen, it's networking has a bad name to it, right? Everybody hears networking and everybody's skin crawl, and certainly it's gotten a bad rep, but I'm a big believer in writers going out there and making friends, right? Yeah. Networking at the end of the day is relationship building. So there's some basic rules to it. Don't relationship build with people you don't like. It'll never be earnest, genuine, authentic. Let it go. They're not going to do for you. You're not going to do for them. You don't like each other. It is not a conversation starter. You know, always build relationships in the spirit of curiosity and generosity. Who are you? Tell me about yourself. What is your story? What have you done? How can I help? Conferences are great. Events are great. Like any opportunity that you can find. Some people are not in LA and feel like I can't go to whatever Thursday night West Side Writer events exists or whatever. So you make a choice to say, okay, I'm going to go to AFF every year. I'm going to invest in that. Or I'm going to go to WG Fest whenever it's back on its feet, which is the Writers Guild Fest or anything like that. But you really have to kind of pick and choose. I think classes, specifically with some of the kind of more industry established writing programs, are great ways to meet other writers, to make friends, to sometimes meet writers who are ahead of you in the game. But it is an effort that has to be ongoing, because I think all too often writers are like, nope, it's just the writing. It's all the writing all the time. Sit down, write a script, work really hard. You know, whether they pay for some notes with you guys, or whether they work with a consultant or whatever their drill is, all of which is fine. But then look up and go like, okay, script is done. I don't know what to do. And then kind of cobble together an effort that's not really thoughtful, because they don't have a network. They don't have kind of pre-existing relationships with three other writers, right? Who mm-hmm. are maybe a step or two ahead to go back to and say, okay, I finished it. What do I do now? So it really is about thinking about this kind of self-marketing efforts 12 months a year, not in the two after you finish your script, after which you decide that it all sucks and you don't want to do it.
I'm going to make one. We'll probably, Jeannie, I'll have you delete this later, maybe. I do want to mention one thing, because I see well-meaning writers make this mistake all the time, where they come across as like needy. Like it's very clear. I mean, you can spot, we all have really good radar for this now. Like you can spot when someone is talking to you because they need you for something, rather than actually genuinely wanting to, like, you know, learn more about you or read your scripts or, you know, become an acquaintance in the screenwriting community. The ones that are a little bit more passive, but still like ingrained in the community, those are the ones that really come across as genuine. Maybe some of them aren't, I don't know, but at least they're coming, at least they're putting forth an effort.
And right? I think you can spell desperation from far away.
Sure. Yeah.
And I understand that it's really tough to be doing this for a while and not be like, what is happening? And I'm getting good feedback on the work. Why is nothing happening? Who's going to help me out? But it's just about learning how to conduct yourself in a manner that you, the writer, are comfortable with, that isn't off-putting. I say all this and I kind of cringe, because I feel like I understand why people don't want to wait, right? And want to get out there.
Frustrating, yeah.
But, you know, Jeannie knows this about me. I have a rule that I've broken this rule with Jeannie once. I don't ask for favors. I make a point of never asking for favors. I asked Jeannie once and she totally came through. But the reason is I build my friendships and my relationships with people so that when they need me, I'm there for them. And when I need them, they're there for me and I don't have to ask for it. And with Jeannie, it was like barely an ask. She was like, I know exactly. It's all good. I got it. But I think it's really important to build relationships from that standpoint where people are genuinely invested in you and in your success. And it is, at the end of the day, the emerging writer, working writer community, and those emerging writers that go on to become working writers, it's not a five-person community, but it's not a huge, you know, 50,000-person community. So I think it's really important to build relationships where people become invested in you and become fans of yours and, you know, want to see you rise along with them. Yeah, right? There's, you know, send the elevator down, however you want to define it. You want to have those people that get invested in you.
Yeah.
When I was running Script Magazine, I had written a couple articles about finding screenwriting mentors and organically making those connections and making people your fan, you know, like actually, you know, wanting to be your friend and realizing that you weren't you know, there was no desperation smelling at all. And I will put links to those couple articles I wrote about working with people and trying to attract mentors and people who will champion for you. I'll put those in the recording email.
I've been kind of filtering the Q&As organically, speaking of organically, into the to what I was asking.
Yes.
Someone did say, though, and I'm curious what Jeff's thoughts are on this. I've sent out queries before and gotten the classic, "We do not accept unsolicited submissions" response, which often makes me feel like I'm just annoying people I'm emailing. What happens, like, not all managers are open to queries. And I feel like in the film and TV world, it's a lot more nebulous on who's open to queries and who's not open to queries because they don't really advertise it like they do in the lead agent world, for example. So,
I mean, it's one of those things, that statement, "We don't accept unsolicited." In my opinion, an unsolicited submission is when you attach a PDF or you mail a hard copy of something to someone when they haven't asked for it. Sending an email, which I call is called a cold query. That's, you can do that. That's no one, it does or doesn't accept those. You can put those out. If someone doesn't respond to it or they give you that canned response, it means they're just not taking new clients. But I get emails every day and most of them I can't respond. I just don't have time in the day to respond to them. If I do respond to them, I'm saying, "That sounds interesting. Send me the script." And then I've solicited the script. You know what I'm saying? So I think when people say "we don't accept unsolicited," they're saying aren't looking for new clients. Just think of it as that, as they're basically saying that, because that's what they're saying. You're not sending an unsolicited unless you've attached the script, which, by the way, some writers do that. It's a no, don't ever attach the script, because that is unsolicited. And then if they say that, they are correct. But if you email someone and say, "Hey, would you like to take a look at my script? Here's the logline," and they say, "We don't accept it," you didn't send them an unsolicited thing. You're just asking them if they would consider it. So they're basically just telling you they're not looking for new clients. It's just like a doctor's office. They have no new patients, not taking any new patients at this time. Right. And you just have to just accept that and move on. And if they say that, there's nothing you can do. It is what it is. They're not looking for new clients. Their bandwidth is too full, and that's it.
And I find that usually you get those responses across the board from agencies that really don't, in my experience at this point, unless you are, kind of a just emerged agency that is starting out and we don't even know your name as an agency. Generally, agents get their clients from people like Jeff, right? From lawyers, from managers, from producers. So you're going to get it across the board with agencies, which is why new writers, emerging writers should never aim for an agent first. It's always a manager first. And I find that most will they're not going to not receive the email. They just may not respond. And if they don't respond, then either they didn't respond to the query, they're not taking on a new client right now, and move on. And if you have something else that's right for them in 3 or 6 months or whatever, you can try again, but you really get like that one shot.
That phrase, "We don't accept unsolicited submissions," comes from a culture where people send in a document. They send a script to someone, PDF, an email or hard copy. And then it becomes a legal liability. So like at CAA and other agencies, they get all these, the mailroom gets hit with all this copies of scripts. And this goes way back before email existed. And then that writer can say, if they see a movie come out by a client of that agency that's similar to their script, they can say, try to sue them and make a claim. So the agencies would take those scripts that would come in, they put a paper on it, say, they'd actually mail it back to that person and say, "We don't accept this. And this is a legal document saying we never read it." So they couldn't get a liability later. But it's been adopted, that "We don't accept unsolicited" has been adopted as, "We're not accepting new clients now." So when people send the cold query, they're not really. But anyway, it is what it is.
Pre-strike, post-strike, don't send your script unless someone requests it, basically.
Yeah, you should never send the script. That is unsolicited. But if you're sending a cold query and someone says, "We're not accepting unsolicited," they're saying, we're not looking for new clients. Or at least we're not going to take clients. We won't accept clients from this way. It's going to come in through a referral. That would be the more technical thing to say. The technically correct thing to say is, "We only accept new clients if they come in from a referral or from a manager, agent, producer, whoever, from you've placed or won a competition, or we're just not looking at all for new people." The unsolicited thing, it's just they're borrowing that phraseology from when people would send things out, and sometimes do still. We still sometimes get it. In that case, it's correct if someone actually tries to send you the full thing.
Yeah. On that note, actually, too, now that we are past the WGA strike, this is a loaded question. I don't know how you're going to answer shortly, but good luck. there's the film world, from my perspective, feels like everyone's kind of requesting what they were requesting pre-strike. It's almost like the strike never happened in terms of requests, like horror, thriller, et cetera, et cetera. Not the same for TV. And I know probably most of these attendees are screenwriters, but maybe they do both. I don't know. But I do want to touch upon like the TV landscape just to get your ideas on where it's going. Obviously, there's going to be this contraction phase for the foreseeable future, right? But how does a newer, really good TV writer kind of break into that now limited sort of sphere, so to speak?
Breaking into the TV.
Yeah.
Do you want to take it, Jeff, or should I jump in?
You jump in. Feel free.
All right. So TV has always been hard to crack. Mm-hmm. You know, pre and post contraction, there is going to be a contraction. But again, I mean, we're going from 600 shows a year to what? 520, 500, 540, you know, 495. There's still going to be a lot of TV that's being made. And now we have some standards for room sizes and things like that. But TV has always been a much tougher nut to crack than features, because features is a bit of a Wild West, right? I mean, you have a great script, you can come out of nowhere, you can end up on the blacklist. I actually think that the fact that there isn't a blacklist on the TV side is very telling of the corporate nature of evaluating TV and TV writers, right? It's not about like, this is just a great script, so you got to read it, right? You know, Court 17 was number two last year. You guys have had a bunch of other script that came from Script Pipeline, but it just speaks of, mm-hmm. of it's just great writing. With TV, it's a much more relationship-driven world. It kind of is a longer pursuit. The good news there is that you still have fellowships, and Warner Brothers just open again, and their newly released Warner Brothers Discovery Access program. You know, ABC Disney now has a deadline coming up, so those fellowships remain a path in. But because, you know, every production company that has an overall deal is potentially, if you look at it from the flip side, exposure for their home studio, there tends to be a lot more caution in reading unknown writers that are not coming in from reps or people that know the writer. There just seems to be more caution in that world because, you know, there's just kind of such a clear connection to whatever the mothership is. So I do find that cracking TV oftentimes can happen through a great feature script. It is relationship driven. And if you have a great pilot, like, yeah, you're going to get read, but it's, you know, that exposure is going to be really important for it. Because I think that it's harder to show up in TV with just a great log line and that's it, and either get staffed or get to, you know, to sell the pilot in not in an if-come deal, but actually sell the pilot and develop it with producers. You know, TV tends to develop from within. So I do think it's more challenging, but very much possible. I mean, I think Jeff and I are both kind of seeing a reality in which the majority of my clients who are, I'm not representing, I'm a career coach, and Jeff's clients who is a manager, there is a lot of work in TV, and we see a lot of people breaking in and staying in that space, but the break-in is less vague than it is in the feature space. Mm-hmm. In the feature space, you can be broken in for, you know, years and be on all the lists and take huge meetings and not have made a sale. And TV doesn't happen that way.
They're whole different worlds, TV and features. And breaking into TV is tough, but when you break in, the money is really good. It's just a whole other, you know, so many differences. I don't even know where to start, but on the TV side, you have, you know, you do need a bigger group to sell a pilot, get a pilot set up, get a pilot to series. You need it with a feature. It's like you have the feature and then you need the director and the cast. But with a pilot, you need the director and the cast and the showrunner to team up with the inexperienced showrunner, because most up and coming writers not going to have any experience running a show. So you need that one extra stop with a pilot. It's a big stop, but you need that extra stop. So a full package with a feature is you have a great script, you have a great director, and you have a great either lead or maybe two leads if it's a co-starring situation. With a pilot, you need the pilot episode, you need a showrunner, an experienced writer producer, team up with the baby writer or younger up and coming writer, whatever, that has less experience. And then you need the director for the pilot, possibly cast, sometimes cast. And then you also need like a format. You need to know where it goes from the pilot, because the feature, it's beginning, middle, and end. pilot, you need to tell the network, this is where it goes, and this is why it can sustain for two or three seasons. So I always tell clients, harder to sell a TV series and get a TV series ordered versus selling a feature and getting a feature greenlit. But the money is better because as the creator of the pilot, you're going to get producing fees as well as writing fees. With a feature, you're probably not going to get a producing credit or fee unless you have some kind of leverage in the deal. It was a competitive situation. So we had the leverage to say, well, the writer wants to be a producer too, and then get producing fees. But the producing fee would be a one-time fee. It wouldn't be per episode. So there's just more opportunities, more business, more money, more everything on the TV side, but it's harder. So it's
more
like
moving parts,
but more money.
Yeah, parts equals more difficult. Here's a question for, I guess, mainly for Jeff. When someone asks me, like, what should I be writing for, like, you know, the feature space? I'll say anything that's fun to read and cool. And they're like, okay. And then they go and do that. And then that's it. That easy. But for TV, when someone asks me that now, getting into this sort of like newer landscape, right? Not to draw too fine a point on it, but like TV's going to change now for a while. What should they be writing? Basically, what do I tell them to write?
Well, I mean, I think it's the same. The principles are the same with features and TV when it comes to a writer that has no representation, no credits, no track record. You're just getting started in the business. You need to write a script that serves as a sample to attract representation first, and then later build a fan base among producers.
Writing with the intention of like, this is probably going to be a sample.
Why not for the first one? Yeah, absolutely. Cause then it's like, you write something like we talk about feature voice samples. And also we talk about stunt specs scripts that are like, the intention isn't so much to sell it as much to attract representation and get representation and also get general meetings and build a fan base. It's the same thing. So like, write a pilot where the log line is buzzy, loud, crazy, zany, stands out from a pack of 100 log lines. And then maybe it's going to raise the likelihood you'll attract representation, get a manager and or agent, and then so on. And so then we'll take it out, and knowing that it's going to be hard to sell it, but it's a great staffing sample, might get you a job. So I think that principle,
Theoretically, there's still a chance that a newer writer, if they wrote something that like only they could write, it's a concept that's personal, that's high concept. There's still a chance that they can actually package that and sell that show.
Yeah.
Everything is possible in this industry is the beauty of it.
I know the answers to some of these questions. I'm saying it because the people here need to be reminded sometimes.
I always tell writers it's
not
like,
as bleak as they think. Yeah.
I wish I had an illustration I could share, but I call it the originality spectrum. On one side, you have familiar, seen it a million times, low originality, low concept. And on the other side, you have highly original, highly unique, the more unique something is. And I think this pertains to film and TV, probably a little more to film, but the harder it gets to get it made, to get it financed, the more unique it is, but the more it serves, it gets mileage you get as a sample. So if you go on the other side where it's familiar and down the middle, the more likely that could get made. But people like producers who don't have development production financing, they're going to be like, I see that sample all the time. So it's tricky. Like you had original when you're starting out and tack back towards non-original. The more success you have, the more you can tack back. So your first script should be really high concept and unique and strange. And if that ever, and producers will love it, but if they bring it onto the desk of a financier, the financier say, I do circle that go into a circular hole or square that go into a square hole. This is some kind of weird shape that I've never seen before. And I talked to the accountants and the business people, we're not going to do this, but we understand you, great writer. Great. Thanks for putting them on our radar. Producer goes back to the writer and the rep says they won't want to do it. If the writer had written something that was a nice square hole down the middle, the producer wouldn't have loved it enough to take it to the financier to say, hey, let's do this. So it's a catch-22. So, right, I say when you're starting out, right, go original to get fans, to get representation and fans and build a fan base. Then the second one, you come back a little bit towards the middle, and then maybe that one gets set up, but maybe it never gets made. And then you come towards the middle again, and then maybe that one gets made. And then if you're successful, you can down the road, if you want to, you can try to stay original, but if you want to, you can just start throwing them down the middle, softballs down the middle. And because of your credits, they'll get made, everything will get made. You know what I'm saying? If you're a big name right now, you can walk into any room and just say, it's a show about a family living in LA. And guess what? If you're big, if it's Chuck Lorre or whoever it is, we think that's genius. But if my client goes in the room with no credits and says it's a family living in LA, they laugh you out of the room. He has to go in, he or she or they have to go in the room and be like, so it's like the Truman Show, except meets, you know, this Jurassic Park where you think you're in this, but actually they're all dead at the end. And it's, and they're like, whoa, I've never heard that before. You know, so the, you know, when you're starting out, it's better to be, think original and unique and make fans of producers and agents and managers and try to get built fans. And then
there's a Goldilocks zone. In other words, with concepts, it's, I know this because most of our winners over the last 10 years have kind of fallen in that. And I think just our sensibilities, but also like really what we're looking for as a competition platform. I want the thing that's off the wall kind of, but also is like, it's hitting on familiar themes. It's a little bit more universal, generally speaking. I mean, we've had winners that are like a lot more straight down the middle genre stuff. We've had Cauliflower, right? For those of you who read Cauliflower, that was number one on the blacklist a couple of years ago. That's like on the other end of the concept spectrum. So,
By the way, the blacklist, think about it. It's the best unproduced scripts. Why are they all unproduced? Cause they all have a common thread. A lot of them are weird and strange, and producers in Hollywood that don't finance production absolutely love them. But when they're brought to the suits and the people with the money and the accountants and the little book, blue books, they're like, we don't know what we can't, it's going to put a gun in his hand and there's a robbery and then the good guy and there's a happy ending and we don't want it. So I always tell writers, you can't look at you can't look at the quote unquote market as one group. It's two groups. You have producers and financiers. Financiers have money that they can lose. Producers, they get their fee for when the movie goes into production, and it can't be taken back from them if the movie is a bomb. They don't lose that money. So they have less to risk. So they're like, I want to do original stuff and unique stuff and win an award. And the financiers are like, can you put a gun in his hand and give it a happy ending? And can we want to sell some popcorn? Can you make it a little funnier? It's when we're out on meetings, like me and my colleagues, we took a bunch of meetings during the strike, general meetings, and we weren't submitting anything. We were just talking to people and producers. The words we heard, that when we talk to producers, people who don't have production finance, the words we hear the most are grounded, elevated, smart, you know, unique, bold. We go to buyers and we hear broad, fun, four quadrant. They want what the market, the general audiences want. They want what they're what makes money. They're like, we don't need to be unique and change the thing. We just want to do this. And that's the difference in town. So when you're starting out, you really want to, and you want to get a reps, you want to get a manager and agent, and then you want to build fans among producers, because they're the ones that bring things to the buyer. If we could circumvent that step, we would, but we can't, because the buyers look to the producers as tastemakers. So we can't, you know, if a client of mine writes a down the middle familiar idea that's very broad, I wish I could just go to the buyers who would love it and welcome it. They'd be like, this makes money. We know this. We've seen this every day. But they're just going to go, who are you? We have a first look deals with 30 producers on the lot. We're spending millions. They should be bringing this to me. If I bring that familiar thing to those producers, the producers go, boring, because they don't have money skin in the game. It's just their time and energy. They're going to say, boring, bring me something unique. And the word familiar, we hear that as a reason for passing so often from producers. Buyers, that word isn't a terrible word, because they're like, familiar means you're probably not going to lose any money. But they're never going to get anything familiar from producers, because producers don't want to do. They want a unique and original. So it's a conundrum. It's
bridging that gap between two sensibilities is the hardest thing, right?
Art versus entertainment, art versus commerce. The biggest fight that's been waging since the beginning of the industry as a whole is in a nutshell, is what I'm talking about. It's managers, agents, producers, artists, writers. We all want fresh, unique. And then the people at the very top, they get that stuff. That's why most unique things that get made, it's the package. I have a client who wrote a really unique script years ago that was on the blacklist, and it's very close to getting made because a producer really dug it, rolled up their sleeves, came on board and put a full package together. And even with the full package there, the financier is reluctant. Like, you know, it's like pulling teeth.
Right.
But they've done the math and they pulled out the calculator and they see some money and they're, we'll take a look at this. But if they had their way, they wouldn't be doing that film, because it's too unique. But so packages make anything possible. You can anything unique that's different, doesn't fit a square or round peg, is all about the package. It didn't come to the buyer as a spec screenplay. It came as a full package, and they you know, looked at it and said, all right, well, like this director's pretty big, this actor's pretty big, we'll do this. So packaging's mm-hmm. where it's all at. It's, you know, but yeah, that's the frustrating thing about our business is that if you go too down the middle, producers won't like it at all. And if you go too original, producers will love it and buyers will say, what the hell are you guys thinking? Like, this is like, yeah. You think of like Bo is yeah. Afraid. I love Bo is Afraid's great. Ari Aster's all, he's great. That's a weird movie that Bo is Afraid. Imagine that as a spec if one of my clients had written it, we were just out with it. And like, I don't know what it is. Is it a comedy? Is it a horror movie? It's so unique and different.
Well, Thank You for Smoking or yeah. Everything Everywhere. Well, maybe that.
Everything like, Everywhere All At Once. Great. Great. Yeah. Absolutely great. That's one that's so yeah. unique and it's, you know.
It would have killed it in spec, probably. I was going
to ask. I just want to pay attention to time because we're.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
We could talk. No, that's fine. Because it's really fascinating. And I think all of those aspects are things that writers don't necessarily think about when they're just like, oh, I have an idea. I think I want to write it. You know?
Right.
I just want to, because we could talk. I feel like this session could be a 6-hour long
session. Jeannie, can I just throw one thing in for writers who are writing TV? It's really important to know your comps. It's really important to know where your show lives, because if you're coming in and you're saying there's nothing like it has ever been done, usually it's with some reason or some sensibility. So I think it's really important to know how your show, specifically on the TV side, is same, but also how it's different, right? If it's in a particular space, how it's billing on the shows that have come before. You know, I think if you look at, for example, TV and you say, you know, I have my comps are, you know, shows that were on in the 90s, we need more current comps to understand where that show lives today, not in the 90s.
Hmm.
Similar to books, you know, mm-hmm. the comps of books. I want to just quickly brush on pitch decks. Like a lot of people will create a pitch deck and, you know, like a lookbook and where would that fit in the line? Is that after, like, say you like their query letter, I mean, and their log line, would then you ever ask for a pitch deck? Or would you, is that something like,
when? And does it depend if it's still on the TV?
For me, right. It's pitch decks created after you represent, you've signed someone and you're actually about to take out a piece of material. And if they're attached to direct it, there should be a director's lookbook or a pitch deck of some sort. If it's just a pitch, they need a pitch deck. Or if it's a pilot and you write a series overview, series Bible or something. But I wouldn't look at one of those as to consider a client, to signing someone as a client. I'm just going to read screenplays and teleplays. Mm-hmm. And then if I sign them and we're working on something, and then that as a supplementary tool, we decide that it's right to do that. Of course, we'll do one of those. I do a lot with pilots because it's only the beginning of the whole thing. So most clients, they have a pilot, they've got to write something or, you know, whether it's a few pages or a whole illustrated deck, where it goes from there. But I wouldn't look at that and consider that as for what I'm considering for representation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I find that there's actually, and specifically in the representation market there or representation world, there's very little interest for those. When a writer is taking something out, they're going to create their pitch pages when they're taking something out with a representative. But otherwise, for me, you know, it's always about first and foremost the script. Then every writer wants to have kind of a log line down, a synopsis down, if it's a TV show, a series Bible so that they can show the legs on the show, and like a short elevator pitch so that they can comfortably speak about the work. But I am not finding that lookbooks or, lookbooks are more specific for directors, but rather pitch decks are getting a ton of requests. Sometimes working writers will put it together because it helps them communicate their vision for the show, but that usually is once, just like Jeff said, there's representation on the material who's taking it out and decided that it's a good supporting piece of supplemental material to have on the pilot.
Mm-hmm. You know, if you wanted to grab another question or two from the list,
there's a lot. There are a lot. Some of them, I feel like you've touched a lot on a lot of them. I mean, like if you want a contest, mention it.
I was going to ask just really both of you, like Lee, what do you recommend? Because I'm sure a lot of your clients, obviously you're helping them like with their queries and stuff as well, right? And that whole navigational process. What do you recommend they... have to include in it, and this is such a basic question because, you know, but I, again, just to reinforce it, what do you suggest they absolutely include in a query? Do they want to, I always tell writers, don't get too cute with it. You're right. But you also want your voice to come through, correct?
If you're able to do that, yes, absolutely. I find that humor is tough.
Yeah.
You know, it's very difficult to land a joke in a query.
Yeah.
But we always, if a writer is able to ingest some voice, voice is important. It's important on the page. It's important in the script. I mean, Jeff was talking about the scripts that get attention. We keep talking about samples that are voicey and noisy. And I think if you can apply that voice gracefully to a query, by all means, but don't try too hard because, you know, we see it from a mile away when somebody's trying too hard. You know, you want to include the one log line. Don't give somebody 15, just like we talked about earlier. Don't not include a log line. And I've seen certainly writers do the like, well, I have a number of scripts to my name, but would love to have a coffee with you and discuss. Or let's hop on Zoom sometime. Which I understand everybody's asking for a read and writers are like, I'd love to talk to you, Jeff Portnoy, and see what you're into and then know what to send to you. But you rarely are going to get responses on that, especially without a referral. A referral may, if their referral is close enough, and somebody who's like, Jeff, you know, friends with Jeff's second cousin, may reach out to Jeff and say, hey, can you do like a 20-minute Zoom coffee? Maybe. I don't know. And nobody reach out to Jeff's second cousin now. This is not what I was trying to start. But I think it's really important to have kind of the log line. But I think it's also important to be clear about what you write, right? Because if you send somebody a comedy and then you come back and you have a thriller and then you have a small family drama, who are you as a writer? We want to understand your brand and we want your body of work to speak to that brand without us having to ask about it. What do you write? What do you write can be broader or narrower, what inspires you, and it can tie into your personal bio. But we want to understand your general space because Jeff was talking about building fan bases for his writers, right? And the producer sector and the executive sector. Guess what? Those producers and those executives are making a certain type of show. They're making a certain type of movie. Nobody, unless you're a studio with multiple divisions within the existing studio, nobody makes every type of film, every type of TV show. So in order for somebody like Jeff to be efficient for his clients and to, you know, he's working really hard and he wants to get the most out of everybody that he signs and give them the best opportunity, understanding the brand of what the writer writes is really important. If you can begin to communicate that in a query with a, you know, not overbearing, but recognizable voice, I think that goes a long way.
Let me ask you this. I guess, Jeff, and this will apply, I think all these writers will have the same question. I have the same question still. When you talk about applying your personal, like, writing style, your own brand, that doesn't have to be limited to a genre. And I want to stress that, like, a writer can kind of have that same voice across multiple genres. But how many clients do you have that can write horror just as well as just as good as they can write comedy or write thrillers just as well as they can write, you know, sci-fi or something? It's limited, I would assume, right?
Well, I mean, look, my advice to writers, I think you put two categories. First of all, there's TV and there's film. And then within each category, there's writer for hire and creator. On the TV side, you have the writer for hire and creator. I mean, you kind of effectively have that on the feature side. But I think it's important as a creator for television or as a feature writer, someone who produces scripts with the intention of getting, not using them as samples to get jobs, but to get them made. Mm-hmm. You want to have a brand when you're starting out. You want to have a brand. Hollywood wants to pigeonhole everybody, and you want to let it pigeonhole you until you have the capital and the leverage to then expand and then even more capital to make a full pivot later. So, like, I've had clients that when I discovered them, they were right. They had a script in every different genre. They wrote a script in every, they had a horror, a comedy, a drama, you name it, they had it. And I took them all out different times. But when we got traction on one of them, let's say it was a horror script. I would say, okay, we finally got some traction. You're building a fan base. You have these fans. You got 25 writers, 25 producers that loved your script, took a general with you. We got to follow it up. They're waiting for the next one. They're not waiting for the next comedy because you wrote this is a horror script. These are horror producers. So then they followed up with a horror script. That one gets optioned. Maybe it gets on a list. Maybe it gets produced, whatever. And then they do a third and a fourth, and we're building. So that's what we're building a brand, and now they're known as the horror writer or the horror writing team. Everyone mm-hmm. has a horror. They come to me. Oh, we want those guys, or we want that writer. They're going to get, not as artists, they're going to get over time bored of being pigeonholed. They're going to want to expand, but we don't make a full pivot into like comedy pivot. We expand a little bit. Maybe they do a sci-fi horror or a, you know, psychological thriller or something, and they expand. And then maybe one day they're so tired of being pigeonholed in that whole area, they're like, I always love comedies. I'm doing comedy, but they've had enough produced credits and enough track record where we can make, but it is like not starting over entirely, but it is kind of like hitting the reset button, because mm-hmm. now we're going out to a new group of producers. So I do encourage clients that the goal in when we're starting out is we want to build a brand. On TV, when you're a writer for hire and you're trying to get staff, you can have samples in different genres, and then your rep can use them for different shows. If there's a American Horror Story, we pull out the horror thing. We're trying to get you a job. You're not really you're a writer for hire. So it's a little different. And the same thing with features. If I have a client who has like three or four different samples and I hear there's an open writing assignment, I can send one and say he or she or they would be good for that. But I do think building a brand is important. The question you asked at the beginning, Matt, is a little different. Like, can the prose itself, the voice on the page mm-hmm. translate from genre to genre? Absolutely. I mean, I have a lot of clients that make the reading experience entertaining. So if it's a comedy, I was just reading a spec today from one of my clients who, he always breaks the fourth wall and is cracking, you know, saying like funny things. It's making the reading experience fun, and he made it fun for me today. And he can do that in horror. The thing with breaking the fourth wall and making the reading experience fun is usually that's a comedy or a dramedy. But if you're doing a horror script, it's supposed to be scary. You're not going to say, you're not going to have a little parenthetical say, don't believe me, look it up. You know, when you're talking about something in a story. I do think that making the reading experience fun is a big deal. Because everyone in the business has to read, and we have to read so much that if you make it fun, but it is harder to do that in horror. It's harder to have like a unique voice on the page with horror or drama, because it's supposed to be serious. And when you're breaking the fourth wall and you're having fun on the page, that's usually a comedy or dramedy where you're doing that. And it's like a lot of voicey. You know? But anyway, that's like a separate conversation.
And that's a whole other Zoom. I agree. It's important. But like, that's a fine line too, is because you don't want to get, it's like writing a query. You don't want to get too cute with it, but you also want it to be fun.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But not fun. You know what I mean?
One thing I want to touch on about like, you know, what writers should be writing and branding themselves. Say you've signed somebody, and Lee, you're helping somebody as a career coach, and now they've got representation. Describe your perfect writer to work with. Like, what do you want them to come to the table with? Like, ideally, like how many scripts should they have written? How do you want them? What do you want them to know about what it would be like to work enjoyably with a manager?
And I think Jeff is actually the best position to talk about, because he knows what works for him as a manager. But I think that, you know, from the sidelines, from somebody who's supporting a writer on that journey and on that entry, is you can't be precious, but you have to know when to stand your ground. You have to be collaborative, because you are going to get notes from your rep. It doesn't mean that your rep says jump and you say how high. If you are not agree, if you don't agree with a note that you get from your rep, you want to have a conversation about it. And you have to remember that your reps are constantly also evaluating, like, am I comfortable putting this writer in a room with my friends who are executives? Is this person taking notes well? Are they listening well? Are they taking notes and making them their own, or are they just servicing the note? You want to have ideas. You want to be able to speak to your process, but also adjust to your manager's process. But it's definitely, when you get representation, that's the hard work only begins, because you don't want to be sitting on your hands. You want to be coming up with new concept. You want to be writing pages. You want to be working with full transparency with your rep, so they know what you're working on. You know, if they don't want to develop it with you, in the very least, they have seen the log line or an outline and said, okay, this is good with me, go to it, as opposed to you know, kind of just be surprised with like, hey, here's the script I wrote, why don't you get it out there, that they either don't like the concept or don't like the execution or both. But it's also important to continue to work your own network and relationships, and to continue to hustle, because I find that those things are, when a rep, in my experience, sees a writer hustling effectively and not just sitting on their hands and waiting for their rep to do something, the rep then tends to get inspired and want to kind of match that energy and bring what they bring to the table as well. So I think it's just really important to continue to work smart, creatively, collaboratively, with great transparency, and also giving writer or managers patience. Like, I talked to a client on Friday who is represented and turned something into his manager 2 weeks after the strike was over. And the manager, it's been 2 weeks and the manager hadn't read it. And the writer was getting frustrated. And I understand that, but I had to tell him, like, listen, we're post-strike. Everything is crazy. I need you to give him a little bit of space here. So understanding what's reasonable within the construct of those relationships within the timeline that the industry is working in is also important.
Yeah. I mean, you got to look at the development process like a marathon. You got your reps giving you notes. Then if you get a producer attached, they're going to have notes. Then the financier, then the actor, director, showrunner. If you're doing a TV project and you need an upper level writer to come on board to get it made. It's like a huge marathon, and you just got to be good at, I think, like what Lee had said at the beginning of her answer, which was you have to communicate well on the development side, be able to take the notes and push back when you disagree and accept it when you see that the note makes sense and it's going to improve the project, be able to be humble enough to take the note. And that's it's a personality thing. What we're looking for in the best, when you say what's the ideal client or client manager relationship, it's definitely a personality. You want someone who isn't going to just let you roll over them and taking all your notes, addressing all your notes because they want you to be happy. You don't want someone that pushes up a wall just because they have to be the creator. They won't accept someone else's creative contribution or note, because then it's not 100% their DNA in the project. You just need to find someone that understands the process and knows that it's a giant marathon. When I wrap development on a script with a client, I'm taking it out to producers. I'm passing the baton to the producer. Producer's coming in, and that's just the beginning. It's still at the beginning of the race. And it's who's left standing at the end of that marathon takes a lot of stamina, stamina to deal with that.
I would definitely underscore, it's a cliche analogy, but I would definitely underscore the fact that there's so many moving parts and so many little steps that you have to take before you get to that end goal. And then even when you get to the end goal, there's like more steps you got to take just to stay in that stratosphere, right? Or continue moving forward. I've talked to a lot of frustrated writers this year, especially like during the strike and WGA and not WGA. But now it's like that sort of cynicism, I feel like, is kind of lingering still, but you still have to kind of keep writing and sending your scripts out. Don't be hesitant to say like, well, the market's too hard, so I'm not going to do it. So many writers, Lee's had a lot of clients that have ended up winning or placing in pipeline competitions, but she knows a lot of good writers. Very lucky.
Some really great people have chosen to work with me. It's really all that.
Yeah. 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 Some pretty great writers have chosen to submit to us too. But you've heard this story so often where it's like, well, I wasn't going to send out the script. I'm like, I'm going to take one more chance. And that's the spec that sells for $2 million, for example. Right. So you have to keep taking risks, on yourself and investing in yourself. You can't really sit back on your haunches, especially not anymore, right? You never could, but definitely not in the 2024 post-strike world. So
totally agree.
We're 5 minutes over. I'm sorry.
We're 5 minutes over, but I do want to ask one question because it's probably the most common question I ever hear. Like, is that when you're an international screenwriter trying to break in, or you don't live in LA or New York, when should you make that move, and do you have to make that move, and are there things that they could do from where they are before they make the move?
So I think that on the side of everybody who's not in LA, I think, you know, COVID really kind of changed the world in a way that's beneficial to people who are not in LA, specifically on the feature side. And I think at this point, you can remain a feature writer without moving to LA, but understanding that you're going to have to come in for trips. You're going to have to come in for meetings when, you know, should people want to meet in person. It's going to be on your dime. It's going to be on their schedule. You just have to understand that. I think for TV, I mean, I have an EP who is New York based, who got a job, who moved back to LA yesterday, right? Her room is starting on the 13th. So I do think that while there's still some Zoom rooms, everybody prefers an in-person room and just finds them more effective for TV development. So I do think that if you want to be a TV writer, you should expect to have to come to LA and probably be here for some time before you staff. A lot of people ideally say, you know, I would love to like get a job and move. And I think that that is absolutely the ideal situation. But ultimately, I find that most writers who end up getting that job in TV, if as you know, most do start by staffing and then sell later, they usually would have had to be in LA a little bit sometime before that. Do I know people who haven't? Do I have clients who have gotten staffed while not living in LA? Absolutely. I had a client in Seattle who was staffed, who did a workshop with a showrunner that really loved her and then ended up bringing her into a mini room. And would fly in on Sunday night and fly out on Friday night to go be with the family. That's a choice for the writer, and that's a relationship that was established there. So it is possible, and I think it's really important to remember that everything is possible in this industry, but in all likelihood, if you want to staff in TV and work your way up, you will have to get to LA.
Yeah, I mean, thanks to the pandemic and Zoom, to be a creator, film or television, you don't have to live. If you have representation, you don't really have to live in Los Angeles if you don't want to. When it comes to being a work for hire to get writing assignments, especially in the TV world, you probably have to be either live here or be willing to move here. If you're not willing to come here, if you get a job, then you can't. You have to disclose. Like if I'm considering a potential client, and the writer lives in London, and I say, if you got a job here in LA, a staff job, would you come here? And they say, no, I can't. I'm not going to put them up for jobs here. And that might affect my likelihood of signing them. It's just that takes them out of the standing. I think if you come to LA, you increase your chances. If you're able to come, you should probably, because in addition, if you have reps, you're still going to be going to the grocery store, you're going to go to the bar, and you're going to bump into someone who could get you a job. So I think if you really deep down have the bug to work in film and TV, if you can, you come here, you should. You don't have to, especially post-pandemic. You don't have to, but if you could, it's better. It'll raise the likelihood you can get discovered. Because I've had clients email me, hey, I was at a party, or I was at a bowling alley last night, or a bar, and I bumped into this, the creator of a show, and they want me to meet tomorrow morning, or I was at a restaurant, I had met this person. So moving to LA is, I think, a great step if you want to work in the business. But some people, it's not possible. Therefore, you have to be resigned just to be a creator of things. So if you're living in Paris, you can have representation in LA. Write a bunch of features. Your reps can sell that. Maybe we can get you a job, but because of Zoom and everything. But for TV, they're going to want you to come here probably sooner or later. So it limits you. It's limiting, and therefore you should only do it if you have to. So it limits you. Mm-hmm. If you can't get a visa or a green card, then that's fine. You have representation, you're good. But if you live in the United States and you could, and you're not tied down because of family or some other job, and you can come here, you might want to, because you're gonna be meeting so many people and your neighbors. You're gonna move into an apartment building in North Hollywood when you move out, right? And your neighbors are gonna be like, you're gonna have a job the next day because your buddy is gonna be like, yeah, my neighbor works on a show and he got me a job. Some people can't. And if you can't, it doesn't mean it's impossible. You just need to find good reps and have representation and be okay producing material that we can take out and sell and getting paid that way versus being put up for jobs where, but again, Zoom and the pandemic has revolutionized that. I mean, before that, I'd be like, but it's, so there you go.
Yeah. And even like I used to, my friends in LA would say to me that I had more meetings than they had because when I came in, people would make the time to see me because I'm like, oh, I'm going to be here for a week and we'll be here for 2 weeks. So, and there's strategies of how to do that, but always, 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 always make trips to LA, like meet the people you met online, like say, hey, I'm going to have a meetup at X Bar in Studio City, come meet me. And then that turns into, oh, I know somebody I want to introduce you to. And then you have another, like I used to gain 5 pounds every time I into LA because I never ate alone. At breakfast with somebody, lunch with somebody, coffee with somebody in the afternoon, dinner with somebody, drinks at night. Like you, it's, you make the most of that time and you have to make that effort so people understand you're serious about this. Like you really want this.
But basically if you can't be here, you should have a good reason not to. If I've got clients, they've got family, they've got reasons why they can't work in the United States because they're, you know, they don't have a visa or green card, they have family somewhere or some reason, have a good reason. If you don't, if you're like, I just like to live in Nebraska, you know, I just like it here. I just rather live here than LA. I mean, it is expensive. They just said LA is the most expensive. They just voted that. Didn't you guys hear that? They said LA is the most expensive city,
right?
Which I always thought it was New York and San Francisco. Now they're saying LA. That's just insane. I get that. I get that. But it does, if you can, you should. But if you can't, it's not at the end of the road. We can figure it out. Representatives, that's why reps live here, because we're doing it for you, you know, so we can liaison with producers and executives for you guys. But it limits you for sure.
Well, this was really wonderful. We can't thank you guys enough for sharing all this. And I feel like we really could talk all night.
We could. Thank you for having us. I mean, this is such great work with writers. Really appreciate you having us on. I'm speaking for Jeff now all of a sudden, but
This was great. You both are wonderful.
But before all you guys go, remember Jeff was talking about the logline thing and how important that is. Just FYI, we happen to have a logline workshop next Wednesday as a symposium, and it's a really good one. Meredith is amazing on the fly, and will literally workshop your loglines live. And we don't send that out on demand. We only share it with the people who signed up. To protect your privacy of your log lines and stuff like that. But that's next Wednesday. If you look on symposium.pipelineartist.com, you'll see a link for it, and I'll put it in the recording email. But I will hopefully 15th. Get that recording. November 8th.
This Wednesday, you mean?
This Wednesday.
You're saying next Wednesday. Is next Wednesday this coming Wednesday? Or is it?
It's the next Wednesday.
No, but next implies the week after. I just wanted to clarify.
See, this is what it's like when Matt and I work together. These are the little...
Just saying, that's what next means.
Just saying, this exciting life we have. Okay.
Wednesday, the 8th. Yes, this is the long life
this
workshop.
Wednesday, the 8th. I stand corrected. So I'll get you guys the recording email. So thank you, everybody, so much. And let us know if you have any other questions, and you can email us symposium@pipelineartist.com.
Symposium is brought to you by Pipeline Artists, a division of Pipeline Media Group. To learn more about upcoming live symposiums, visit symposium.pipelineartists.com and follow us on Twitter @pipelineartists.